From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young in Tallahassee, Florida.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Former Vice President Joe Biden is among the latest in a list of prominent Democrats and critics of President Trump who have been mailed suspicious packages. Others were addressed to actor Robert De Niro, Congresswoman Maxine Waters, former Attorney General Eric Holder, former CIA Director John Brennan, former President Obama, and philanthropist George Soros, as well as Hillary Clinton. All told, 10 packages have been recovered this week. Some included pipe bomb-like devices. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders appeared on Fox News this morning. She said there are major differences between Democrats and Republicans, and there's nothing wrong with pointing out those differences, but there's something wrong with taking that to a point of violence.
The president has condemned that. All of us have, but certainly perfectly acceptable. And frankly, the president's responsibility to lay out the political differences between Democrats and Republicans as we head into a midterm election.
At a rally last night in Wisconsin, President Trump called for unity and lobbed some of the blame for the current political climate at the news media.
The media also has a responsibility to set a civil tone and to stop the endless hostility and constant negative and oftentimes false attacks and stories.
So we'll keep following the politics of this. Meantime, investigators have a big task in front of them to find the person behind these packages. Joining us now is Jimmy Oxley, a professor and bomb expert at the University of Rhode Island. Jimmy, welcome.
Thank you.
And you've assisted in federal investigators in analyzing bombing incidents before. When you look at this string of suspicious packages, what stands out to you about these compared to other past incidents?
Only the fame of the people who are being targeted. If we look at past bombing incidences, we just haven't had such high-profile victims. If the first set of bombings actually date back to the early 1900s when it was a labor rising. But probably in your listeners' remembered history was the Unabomber, or Leroy Moody, or Eric Randolph, who were doing abortion clinics. But those seem almost faceless to us.
Do you think we'll figure out who's doing this?
I'm sure that we will. What I've done from law enforcement in the past is really research pipe bombs. I've shot 130 pipe bombs, looking at how they fragment, looking at how little material you can put in them to get a true detonation. The fragmentation study really was if we could decide what had been in it, if it had already exploded. Now, in this case, law enforcement is fortunate because they have intact devices and nobody was hurt. So there's tons of evidence. I think they'll be resolving this rather quickly.
What does it tell you that none of these so far have exploded?
I hope it means we're a whole lot smarter. After the Amtrak letters a few years ago, we instituted a whole bunch of ways of screening mail that we felt was legal. The post office has a very strange little balance they try to maintain between privacy and protection. So for government officials, the mail goes through a screening protocol. I'm sure for some of these high-profile people, like George Soros, he has his own little protective protocol and looking at these. So they were detected. Now you can speculate that they didn't go off because they were only meant to scare, and I've heard people speculate that. But without knowing anything about how they're putting together, we haven't seen anything but external pictures yet. It's too soon to speculate that, and it has to be treated very seriously and assume that we've done a great job on detection.
What would be the first thing you would do to try to figure out where these are coming from?
Well, looking at the postmark, and there was a postmark that I could see on one of the pictures, locate where they might be sent from. In the case of ones that were hand delivery, I'm sure they're knowing that. There's going to be a lot of video evidence of where they are coming from. There's evidence all over the outside of the packaging that you can believe somebody is going through. And then in terms of the actual pipe, the clock, all of that, they're going to look for where this was acquired. They're going to start in the area where they think the bombs originated and move out from there to see who bought it. I think each of us is on video more times than we think we are in this modern day and age.
You say that we are getting smarter now. Does it look like the person who is doing this is a sophisticated attacker?
Do I think he's sophisticated? I don't think you have to be terribly sophisticated to do a bombing of any kind. That's why it's over the centuries, it's remained popular. Ever since explosives were invented, bombing has become a way of expressing unhappiness or anger.
That is Jimmy Oxley, a professor at the University of Rhode Island, who studies explosives, detection, mitigation, and response to things just like what we're seeing right now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's go to Dallas now for an update on the shooting death of 26-year-old Botham Jean by Dallas Police Officer Amber Geiger. You remember when Officer Geiger fatally shot Jean in his own apartment last month? She was off duty, coming home after a long shift. She told police she confused his apartment for hers. But was Geiger acting as a Dallas police officer when she shot the 26-year-old black accountant? Lawyers say she might have been, and that could have big legal implications. Christopher Connolly from member station KERA looks at that fuzzy line between when an off-duty officer is an officer and when they're a civilian.
There's still a lot about the night of September 6th that we don't know. Details of what exactly happened between Amber Geiger and Botham Jean, but one fact that came out early has made it into practically every news story.
The officer was still wearing her uniform when she claims she went to the wrong apartment.
She was still in her uniform.
In uniform.
Full uniform.
Still in uniform during the incident.
And that matters, according to Lee Merritt. He's a lawyer for Botham Jean's family, who says the family plans to sue not just Geiger, but also the city of Dallas. Merritt says Geiger's uniform, her badge, the fact that she used her service weapon, that she says she issued verbal commands to Jean before shooting him, it all matters.
To Mr. Jean and to other members of the public, she is holding herself out to be a police officer, which she in fact is. And so that means she's operating under the color of state authority, and that would make her liable under 1983 in the city as well.
1983 is a reference to the part of federal law that allows people to sue state or local officials for violating their constitutional rights. Jennifer Lauren teaches civil rights law at the University of Texas Law School in Austin, and she says the first step in bringing a lawsuit like this is to demonstrate
that in the course of undertaking the conduct that allegedly caused the violation of rights, that they were acting under color of law, that they were using their state authority in some way.
Basically, that Geiger was acting as a police officer when she shot Botham Jean, that she was not just a regular person. Lauren says the fact that Geiger was off duty is not necessarily the determining factor for a court to decide that.
The police officer, even though officially off duty, right, clocked out, might still be using their official power or using the trappings of their office or using the authority that their position gives them to undertake the actions that are complained of.
If Jean family lawyer Lee Merritt can establish that Geiger was acting as a police officer when she shot Jean, then he can argue that as an agent of the government, she deprived Jean of his constitutional rights. But to go that next step, to prove the city is liable for Geiger's actions on that night, that's more difficult, says Art Brender, a Fort Worth attorney who has tried police misconduct cases.
To hold her employer, the city, responsible under 1983, you have to show that there was a custom or policy of unconstitutional actions, which that policy directly caused his death.
Geiger's attorney hasn't commented on the potential lawsuit, and he's called the killing a tragic mistake. In a statement, a spokesman said the city wouldn't comment on pending litigation, but Lee Merritt argues this city is liable. He says Geiger relied on the Dallas Police Department's training when she decided, inappropriately, Merritt says, to fire at Jean. He goes on to say that the city should have disciplined or retrained Geiger after a previous on-duty shooting that was not fatal and for which Geiger was not indicted. And finally, Merritt says Geiger got the kind of preferential treatment from the department after killing Botham Jean that's reserved for on-duty shootings.
It's that training and it's that protocol and it's that failure to discipline that has resulted in a culture that's quite frankly out of control with the use of deadly force.
Still, legal experts say these suits have a very high bar. Holding cities responsible for their police officers' actions is tough, and in many cases, they can drag on for years. Lee Merritt says he plans to file his lawsuit this week. For Here and Now, I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
We're in Florida ahead of the midterms, and also after Hurricane Michael cut an unbelievable swath through the Florida panhandle in the northwest part of the state, just truly unbelievable to see. A looming crisis, homelessness. FEMA and aid groups like the American Red Cross are providing temporary shelter, but then what? Especially for the poor and the low income? Well, Regan McCarthy is a senior news producer with WFSU, and Regan, I know you and your colleagues have been really pulling at this thread. It's quite a story. Michael made landfall more than 2 weeks ago, but so many people still displaced. Do we know how many?
Right. When I last spoke with FEMA, they told me there are more than 1,000 people in shelters at this point. And of course, we know that not everyone who was displaced by the storm are those people in the shelters. So we can imagine that that number is much greater than that, you know, 1,000 or so people.
Well, some might be with family or friends or in cars. Your colleague Lynn Hatter spoke with Tanja Denise Graham. She was evicted from a low-income housing project in Panama City because of the storm damage. Let's listen.
Currently living in my father's truck, my two kids, myself, and my two parents. I don't have the money right now to afford a regular house. That was a home that I built for my children, which was taken away in a disaster, and then to have to leave unwillingly and, like, forcefully is messed up. Like, I have nowhere to go. Like, I have no one to talk to about where to take my children as far as management. They have not did anything but kick us out.
So you multiply her, I'm sure, by many. And she has been approved for FEMA rental assistance. We forget about, I mean, she was in low-income housing, but there are all these renters who don't have any recourse. She got a FEMA rental assistant and is waiting on a check. But then what? I mean, where is she supposed to, so she can find housing, but where is she supposed to find housing?
Right. That's the difficult thing is that there aren't a lot of places available right now for housing. FEMA has made some hotels available. There are vouchers that you can use to stay at these hotels, but many of them are outside of the hardest hit areas, so people have to have transportation to get there. Mm-hmm. Really, there's about 20 that are accepting those vouchers. They do say, you know, trailers are on the way. People think about those FEMA trailers, but there seems to be, some slowdown in the process. They say they need to work with local governments. They can't just come in there and say, here we come, we're putting these trailers here. The local governments need to ask for it. And of course, those local governments are still putting themselves back together. And so I think that's why we're seeing sort of this slow response.
Right.
There are also shelters, of course.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, we see FEMA people all over the place in their blue t-shirts. They're working very hard. You spoke with Michelle Chestnut, though. She was staying in a shelter in a local high school. I just want to listen to a little.
We stayed in a church. I mean, it was just like all the windows busted out in the back and all the trees come down and landed right beside the church, though. Yeah. I have an aunt. Her house was destroyed. A brother-in-law, his house was destroyed. Yeah, we know a lot of people that's lost their homes.
Well, so first of all, clarify for us, because driving around, this is driven home. We're in the panhandle. People might be picturing, you know, Miami Beach and thinking these are second homes or beach homes. They're not.
Right. This is a part of Florida where we have a lot more rural people, a lot more low-income people. And so these are even people who maybe don't have any insurance on their homes. They are homes that have been handed down for generations. And so since they have no mortgage, they really don't have room in their budget for insurance. They don't have that insurance, which will make this recovery even more difficult. They don't have that way to begin rebuilding their homes.
Well, and rebuilding with what? Because with so many things down, incomes have been cut. Another big challenge is joblessness, that's looming. And you heard from Mickey Gilmore, a Walmart manager in Marianna, who said people are showing up for work even though they have really trying circumstances. Let's hear.
We're getting some coming in because, one, it gives them a stability of life. Plus, we've got air. They don't have anything. And so I've got an assistant manager we call MJ. He lost his whole house. But after 2 days, he's in here with an attitude, smiling and great. It's kind of like he's just glad he has a job that he can recover from. And a lot of associates do that. It gives him a little comfort.
Yeah, when he says, we got air, he means his air conditioning.
Right.
How are people getting by if they have no income?
I think that it's tough. I'm hearing from people who are very concerned about it. Gilmore had opened his store. I mean, it wasn't open to the public, but he was allowing his employees to come in and just help with the cleanup process so that they could get a paycheck. Many of these people are living paycheck to paycheck. There is some unemployment, like specifically storm-related unemployment assistance available through the state. But again, that's difficult for, say, fishermen who maybe mm-hmm. don't have a good way of tracking what their income has been. And so they don't have a good way of applying for that assistance.
Yeah. Well, running water, mostly back in some places, it's not drinkable. Communications, as we have discovered, are still pretty spotty. It's just really, I have to say, it's just remarkable to see the trees uprooted everywhere. Even here, you know, inland, Tallahassee, roofs off high schools 50 miles inland. It's really quite humbling. WFSU senior news producer Regan McCarthy, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you.
Well, we've been talking about housing, even those able to return to homes, and it's unbelievable. Again, we'll have pictures at herenow.org, are having trouble. Here Now's Chris Bentley went to the coast and brought back this look.
Much of the area between Mexico Beach and Port St. Joe looks like a hurricane went through yesterday, not 2 weeks ago. Cars and boats are turned on their sides, strewn across streets and lawns. Homes are split wide open. There's debris everywhere. But for those able to return to their homes, this part of the Florida Panhandle is one big construction site. Troy Bryant watches as workers tear the shingles off his roof.
They've torn all the shingles. I just had the new roof put on last September.
Bryant and his wife, Connie, bought this beachfront property and moved here from Georgia earlier this year. They stayed in a hotel in Marianna, Florida during the storm and returned 2 days later to find their new home intact but severely damaged.
Well, when I first drove up, I thought, well, that doesn't, you know, the garage doors were mangled, but I thought, well, that's not so bad. And then you walk outside to the back door of the garage and it opened up, and then this is what you're seeing right here. Just utter devastation. I had a white picket fence that we had just built all around the front of the house. There's part of it in the back. There was part of it in the garage. That house right there used to be right there.
Bryant says that house is 40 feet from where it used to be. Janice and Alan Cronin live a few blocks back from the beach. They were on vacation in Tennessee when the storm hit, and when they came back, they found 4 feet of water had swept through the building. They also saw whole houses lifted off their foundations and swept into the street by the storm surge and high winds.
This second block, most all the houses have some sort of damage, and of course theirs was pushed so far it got kind of totaled, you know.
And there's a house in the street in front of your house.
Yes. It was a catty corner of that block. And so when the storm surge came up, it started floating, of course, and it just twirled it around and it landed there. And, of course, you see our neighbor's car wound up in her house.
The Cronins are spending their new retirement repairing their house by hand, living out of a camper in their backyard. They're determined to stay. But Alan Cronin says this area will never be the same.
There's a large percentage of these homes that were owned by Grandma, Grandpa. Grandma and Grandpa's not going to rebuild down here. Grandma and Grandpa's going to sell it. Keep in mind that a third to a half the houses down here were actually built before 1970. They were literally not built to any hurricane code. They were built for fishing cabins, and people have lived in them for years. now they're not going to live them anymore. And in 5 years, this won't be the same place it was.
Lifelong residents Clark Downs and his daughter Kimberly Downs Norton rode out the storm in Clark's house.
I was confident on the Category 1 and 2, but then after I realized it was going to be a 3 or 4, it was too late. But luckily, we survived it.
Today, they're helping their neighbor clear downed trees from his yard. Clark says Michael was a historic storm.
There's a history here of even when I started school here in elementary school, there's a book called The Great Tide, where the city was destroyed 3 times, once by fire, once by yellow fever, and once by a tidal wave, which was really a hurricane. So I'm counting this as number 4. But it'll come back.
Why do you say that?
I just know the people here. It'll come back. It's already coming back.
You're already building.
Well, yeah, I've got roofers coming. I've got the people coming to straighten some of the messes out. So, yeah, oh, yeah.
What do you think, Kimberly? How do you think this place will change, or will it?
I don't think it'll change. I just think it'll be more beautiful. We can see more of the stars at night now. You know, we had so many trees before in the yard, we couldn't see that many stars. But now we can look up and see all the stars. But it's going to take a lot of work to get it back together, but we're ready.
Gulf County Sheriff Mike Harrison shares Clark's optimism. He and most of his staff slept in the sheriff's office for more than a week after the storm, helping around the clock with rescue and recovery efforts.
As a lot of people have conversations about where were you when 9/11 happened, our previous generation was where were you when JFK got shot. And I think our generation here is going to say, well, where were you when Michael came through? We've got a long ways to go to get us back to our small hometown proud. We're starting this Friday at 3 o'clock. We're having a hometown football game here. Friday night, Wewahitchka's playing over in neighboring Franklin County. The little things like that are going to get our community back to where it needs to be, but it's just going to take time. But for the world out there, you know, we've got a long ways to go, but we're going to get there.
The people returning to Gulf County have a long road ahead, but Harrison says they're the lucky ones. They have a home left to rebuild. For Here and Now, I'm Chris Bentley in St. Joe Beach, Florida.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The markets are trying to gain ground today after a huge sell-off yesterday. The S&P 500 fell 3%, wiping out gains for the year and putting it in correction territory. That means stocks have fallen 10% from their previous peak. It is a signal to investors that the volatility could be more than just a blip. Robin Farzad hosts the podcast Full Disclosure. He joins us now. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Jeremy.
And all year we've been hearing about the market's record-setting bull run. Then suddenly it started tanking as soon as we hit October. I don't know if they got spooked or what.
Well, that's how this happens historically. New highs, they're built on forgetting things like 2008 or 87 or the flash crash. These spookouts, they happen much more often than they've been happening over the past decade. But if you go and look at the long chart of the Dow or the S&P 500, you'll find that it's ultimately all just noise. Meanwhile, step back from all this. Emerging markets, they've had something of a lost decade. Here in the U.S., our equities, they've had a fab 10 years after their worst decade since the Depression. In the end, I think it all comes out in the wash.
Well, and when you look at the earnings reports that have been coming out from companies, a lot of them are positive. Microsoft is up. Tesla is up and actually profitable for once. Even Ford reported revenue above expectations despite complaining that President Trump's tariffs have cost $1 billion in profit this year. What about all of that?
Look, things could be a lot worse. Profits are still near record levels. Cash buybacks, cash givebacks, dividends, the fiscal environment, it's all extremely favorable. The question is, how much have we been pricing that in for a decade? Look, I'm old enough to remember when the market actually fell 30% in a year, Jeremy. Banks were failing left and right. Every company was suspected of being an Enron or a WorldCom. Mm-hmm. You know, back when the Red Sox were a joke. This is ancient history. People have to remember that things do fall apart.
What about the midterm elections? How do you think that is playing into what we're seeing in the markets, if at all?
Not much. I mean, the market's pretty much priced in the likelihood of Democrats probably recapturing the House of Representatives. There's only so much Congress can do to blunt the worry right now over trade wars or the Federal Reserve ratcheting rates higher.
And what about the idea that the market has been due for a correction for a while, at least according to a lot of analysts? Is a sell-off really such a bad thing if that's what's going on?
I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. Look, my mom used to take me to the Macy's one-day sale on these Wednesdays. Like, we put it on the calendar four or five times a year. I remember Zeke Cavaricci pants were half off. Why then weren't Macy's shoppers mourning the prevalence of one-day sales? Why wasn't CNBC doing special reports on the worrying decline in Macy's prices? Look, stock sell-offs, they're a fact of life. Those who can stay balanced and calm and focused can use these opportunities, whether they're rebalancing or investing more into their kids' 529s. You know, you get it.
But if you're watching and you're looking at your 401k or whatever and you're seeing it fall down, my advice would be just don't look at it when the market goes down. But what's your advice, Robin?
You know, I've told you before to go make a sandwich or Netflix and chill. Today, Jeremy, all I'm saying is all we are is dust in the wind. Stay balanced, stay unexcitable, be greedy when others are fearful. Enjoy the World Series, especially if the Dodgers rally. I sure hope they do.
You're from L.A.
I am in, no, I have a lot of family.
You're from
in
Miami, right?
And that's then, right.
But
that's
you have a lot of family in LA. Okay.
So I grew up loving the Dodgers. It's 30 years, Jeremy. Shed a tear for me.
All right. Well, good luck. They're down 2-0 at the moment.
I'll need more than luck.
Robin Farzad, host of the podcast Full Disclosure. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Which way?
We're Plum.
The other day, we drove outside Tallahassee to the beautiful Wakulla Springs Lodge, where between the lodge and the blue water, some men seem to be surveying. They're archaeologists under white canopies excavating a pit 10 feet wide, 3 feet, and millennia deep.
This has to be lined up just right to make it work properly.
All right.
You got it?
4.762. Dead nuts.
Yeah, you're on it.
On it.
Okay, good, good. I'm Dr. Andy Hemmings with the Osceola Research Institute, and we are at the edge of a pit that we are excavating, dating from modern stuff right at the top all the way down to potentially maybe 15,000 years ago, some of the earliest occupation, not only in Florida, but in the New World.
Wow.
We're kind of just getting to the good stuff. As we get through the earliest Holocene material and get into the end of the Ice Age, the end of the terminal Pleistocene material, we'll be looking at things in the 12 to 14, and it's, like I said, as much as 15,000-year-old range.
Buckets are lined up, shovels gently pushed across the pit's floor, scraping away thousands of years with every layer. Careful, exacting work. You never know what you might hit.
We've been finding stone tools. Just somebody knocked a big flake off. It was really sharp on one edge, so they took a little piece of antler or another hammer stone, perhaps, and just sharpened it up a little bit more. A drill, the tip had broken off of that, and we're probably guessing, in the 5,000, 6,000-year-old range. Part of today's excitement has been that we had a little lens of charcoal, and as we dug it out this morning, it started to have some structure to it. Tom said perhaps corn cob. A corn cob shouldn't be in 9,000-year-old dirt here, but it's conceivable. So that'll be the excitement this afternoon, is removing this little pedestal that's got quite a bit of charcoal in it.
The scraped material is dumped into the buckets and poured out over what looks like a screen door laying on its side on legs. So now we'll move over here to a screen. Everybody knows what this looks like. It's framed, and you're brushing that sand through. What are you looking for?
Flint flakes, the little pieces of stone that they were when they were making a projectile point. There's one.
You've got one there? Put it right in the cup. These are tiny.
Really tiny, because they're taking a deer antler and sharpening an arrowhead or a projectile point, and they make these little tiny flakes.
Look at there. Okay, yeah, you found one down there.
A larger one.
A larger one. It's quarter of an inch long.
Yeah, that's big.
Yeah, that's a big one.
How do you know that's what they were doing with it?
They have what they call these primitive arts festivals where people are making arrowheads today. And this is the debitage that is what's on the floor after they get through making a projectile point.
Yeah. Same thing.
Except this is probably 10,000 years old.
I just touched something 10,000 years old.
Yeah, right. It's cool.
What?
You did it, not me.
It wasn't my hand.
That's Dr. Henning, who just wiped out a few hundred years of history with one football.
There's so many ways to mess up here.
It's funny, but the reason he slipped may not be. Artifacts are most beneficial to archaeologists. They reveal their stories best when they're found where they were left, and storms like the recent Hurricane Michael can disturb that.
If you stand in a place long enough, you can feel the sand compressing a little bit, and it's causing us no end of problems and agitations.
Do you think that's the rain? As you shake your fist at the elements just now?
Impotently.
But these things are thousands of years old, so they've been shifted.
Sure, if they're in place and not currently excavated. And that's really why we were so very concerned, is that we have an open excavation pit almost a meter deep with soils that have not seen the light of day for the better part of 9,000 years. We've made it vulnerable. And so we covered this with tarps, sandbagged the whole thing, and we got off awful light.
And so they continue the work that was started by a man who devoted his life to saving the history beneath Florida's soil and found this site when a sewer pipe was laid.
The original work was done by the then state archaeologist, Calvin Jones, just along the sidewalk outside the lodge in 1994, and that's when some of the most important, earliest finds were made.
Calvin Jones, isn't he the one who got a wheelbarrow of loam delivered to his home? He's the one who realized that there was some ancient tool in that, who said, wait a second. The Jackson Mounds, and he's the one who said, wait a second, this dirt is more than dirt, it's part of this ancient burial site.
They had a delivery of dirt, and within the dirt there were artifacts.
That is archaeologist Barbara Clark of the Florida Public Archaeology Network, and we've traveled to the place where Calvin Jones got his loam and realized it held treasures. It's now the Lake Jackson Mounds Archaeology State Park in Tallahassee, a beautiful carpet of lawn leading to grass-covered hills that rise like the backs of green elephants, one bigger than the others. Okay, we walked across that vast lawn, and there it is. I mean, how high in the air would you say this mound is?
This is the tallest of the seven mounds. It is 36 feet tall. These mounds were built basket by basket load of dirt.
And let's just back up. What exactly is the mound?
This site is actually part of what's called the Southeastern Ceremonial Complex, which is the southeastern region's version of the Mississippian culture, known by many as the mound builders. Over time, they would build these mounds, and their leader would live on top of the mound in a hut. When that person passed, they would then be interred or buried in the mound, and their home would be burned, and then they would cap it off with more soil, and then the next leader would live on top of it. So over time, it became taller and taller, and you can actually see those different layers of soil. If you were to kind of cut this mound in half, you would see evidence of that. You'd see the charcoal from the burned homes. You'd see the burials in the mounds.
Let us climb the mound. And that feels kind of, I don't know, you're walking on someone's funeral pyre. Is that...
It's a place that you have to respect. People lived and died here just as we live and die today. It's definitely a very respectful kind of foreboding place.
Yeah, I feel that. But we are going to climb the stairs to the top of it, as a leader would have done hundreds of years ago. So here we go. Are there native peoples who are direct descendants of the peoples who lived here?
The descendants of the people who lived here were the Apalachee Indians that were here during the time of the Spaniards' arrival. There are still living descendants today. Most of them live in Louisiana and come over for educational events and things like that.
So we're now climbing the wooden stairs up the mound, which is covered with wildflowers. It's actually quite pretty. I know there's concern about how these ancient sites might have been impacted by what was the third largest hurricane, you know, in the country's history. But I'm thinking, since the year 1000 AD, these mounds, and we're right on top now, these mounds have weathered a lot.
Yeah, I think the biggest danger to the mounds would be trees falling over, because they take their root ball with them. And with that, of course, they take part of the mound. And then you have an open place where rainwater can wash away parts of the mound.
Here we are. We're at the top of this mound. We have all this growth. So the leader of a community would get higher and higher and higher above the people. I'm looking now on the big lawn where they'd all be living.
Mm-hmm.
this was strategically placed. Over here to our east, we have Lake Jackson. I always tell people when you're looking for archaeological sites, you look for your basic needs, food, water, and shelter. There are other sites similar to this throughout the southeast, all the way up through the Mississippi Valley, up into Ohio. Even when they were excavating here at Lake Jackson, they were finding copper breastplates, ornate copper breastplates. We don't have copper in Florida. So it was evidence of trade with those other places.
So I understand in this mound, when it was excavated, there would be a family. There was a dog at one point.
They found women. They found one child, I believe, who was about 11 years old. And yes, there was a dog burial.
Why is it so important? This, again, 1,000 to 1,500, a community that lived here before DeSoto came through. What does it mean to you?
I just cannot imagine the level of complexity and organization required. You know, we always think of prehistoric people as primitive, but they were complex. They lived amongst nature, and they were able to take that and work with it to build these massive structures. And I think it's a testament to their abilities as a culture and as a society.
And by the way, if you're in Tallahassee in November, make sure to stop by Wakulla Springs, because Andy Hemmings and his team will be excavating a mastodon.
Flies one into right. This one will drop. Red Sox are on top. 2-run score. It's 4-2.
Red Sox slugger J.D. Martinez put Boston ahead for good last night with that hit in Game 2 of the World Series against the L.A. Dodgers. L.A. will need a very big shovel to dig themselves out of the hole they now find themselves in. Boston is up 2-0, and Game 3 of the best-of-seven series is tomorrow in Los Angeles. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. He joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
And how would you characterize the World Series after two games? Is Boston as strong as they look?
They seem to be. They have been dominating every aspect of the game against the Dodgers team. That's good. That's really good, though they might not have looked it. Maybe the Red Sox MVP, and it's hard to pick one at this point, is their manager. Alex Cora has made all the right choices, in contrast to Dave Roberts of the Dodgers. And maybe in the postseason we'd get on the managers too much. But man, everything, every move, every pitcher he brought in has worked. Credit to them also. And the Red Sox right now, just statistically, with a 2-0 lead, mm-hmm. I think around 85% of teams with a 2-0 lead in the World Series go on to win the series. But they have looked so good and so sharp, the Dodgers have to be very worried.
And you never know after what happened with the Cleveland Cavaliers. They were down, 3-0, and then came back and won the NBA Finals last year.
Yes, but the fact that we can cite the one or two right. instances where this happened, you know, it was the Yankees had that 3-0 lead against the Red Sox in the playoffs famously, but that was the only time it has ever happened in baseball history. And I would say this, if the Dodgers don't sweep, don't literally win all their games in L.A., I can't see much of a chance for them to come back to the cold and for them unfriendly confines of Fenway and win it in Boston. Can't see that happen.
Well, let's talk about that, because I'm here just a few blocks away from Fenway Park. It has been cold. It's been rainy. They're about to go to 70-degree Los Angeles. Does that make a big difference for the Dodgers?
Are you basking in the glow of the Citgo lights? Is that I think it does.
That warms us up very.
Yeah, and the reason that I say it does, and home field per se doesn't have much of an effect in baseball as opposed to other sports, but the Dodgers themselves complained about it. Ryan Madsen, the Dodgers pitcher, said that the cold was preventing him from getting a good grip on the ball, and he used an adjective I hadn't heard in this context. He said, quote, "I didn't feel as gummy as usual when it's 75, 80 degrees. Yes, the cold of Boston getting in the way of Ryan Madsen's gumminess.
Right. Mike, while we have you, I want to ask you about another big story in sports right now. It's in basketball. A top prospect named Darius Bazley is skipping college for a $1 million internship at New Balance. What's going on there?
Two things. One, If he's getting $1 million, it's not an internship. I just wanted to put that out there. But shoe companies realize that the very elite players, not everyone, but the very elite players, some of these guys have, these high school kids have 1 million followers on Instagram. They're very valuable as endorsers. So the NCAA gets in the way of that. And the NCAA says, if you go to college, you can't take any money from an advertiser. But Baisley said, well, why am I spending my time in college? Why would I? He had committed, or at least talked about going to Syracuse. He pulled out, got the $1 million for just endorsing the shoe, and his pro chances stay intact. He has to do, the reason he has a year to kill is because of NBA rules that say you can't come right out of high school. So I think, if anything, this is a good deal for the player himself, and it's another indictment of the flaw of the system that requires essentially indentured servitude, and the NCAA thinks they can continue to get something for nothing, and I think those days are numbered.
Well, I will just say, as the brother of a college athlete, my brother was a tennis player in college,
How much was his internship worth?
He didn't get one, but he was sort of on the pro track and then didn't go pro, and then his college education actually really came in handy, and now he's gone into academia. I mean, there is an advantage of some of these people going to college. I guess maybe they decide, there's absolutely no way I'm not going to make millions of dollars in the NBA.
Right. If the 800th best player decided to do that based on a $25,000 internship with, I don't know, K-Swiss, are they still around? I would say it's a bad choice. But if the number one or two prospect in the country who is guaranteed to make millions of dollars makes that choice, it's different. And tennis is a good example, because there are top tennis players who all the time decide not to go to college. In fact, going to college in a couple sports, tennis primary among them, will probably hinder your development. So, you know, if when your brother was a senior in high school, he was good enough to, which is to say 18 years old, and someone who should be ranked at that age, you know, in the top 50 in the world, he shouldn't have gone to college then. But it's good that he got the college scholarship if he was a, you know, very good but not great or elite or possibly professional tennis player.
He'd still beat me like crazy, even though he did not go pro. Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst, also editor of the book Upon Further Review, The Greatest What Ifs in Sports History. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Thanks to our new friends at WFSU in Tallahassee, David Mullins, Taylor Cox, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Ryan Daly, Tom Flanagan, Kevin McDaniel, also photographer Mark Wallheiser, and the people in the panhandle who talk to us despite having much more important things to do. Thank you, and we will keep a good thought. I'm Robin Young in Tallahassee. It's Here and Now.